Okay, well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to speak in this session. Again, I'll just jump right into it here with an outline. So I'm going to talk about insecticide resistance management in general, kind of some of the biology behind it, what's going on, and then dive into soybean aphid as a case study. That's the critter I spend most of my time thinking about in Minnesota, looking at some of the background on soybean aphid, why it's important, just in case you're not familiar with that pest, the issues we're seeing with resistance, and then some of the strategies we should be thinking about in regards to resistance management for soybean aphid. So insecticide resistance, herbicide resistance, fungicide resistance, we'll be hearing about these different kinds of resistance, but I'm hoping the definitions of resistance will line up pretty closely. Throughout the presentation, I'm sure there'll be some subtle differences in different things we're saying, but I think overall, you know, a lot of what's going on is pretty similar. So for insecticide resistance, we're looking at a genetically based decrease in the susceptibility of a pest to a pesticide. An example being the Colorado potato beetle. And keep in mind that resistance is not the same as tolerance or inherent susceptibility. These two things, the tolerance and this inherent susceptibility, are more related to the baseline susceptibility of a pest before it's exposed to the pesticide, whereas resistance is something that's going to be developing over time after exposure. An example there for tolerance would be, a lot of different caterpillars, like the corn earworm, where the smaller, earlier instars of the caterpillar are more susceptible than the larger caterpillars. That's not due to resistance, that's just the inherent susceptibility of those smaller instars compared to the larger ones. So how does resistance develop? This is just kind of a very quick, kind of cartoon type overview, but a few things need to be occurring. There's variability in susceptibility to that pesticide within the population of the pest. That variability is heritable, so it's passed on from one generation to the next. And some of those variants can survive or reproduce better than others. So in the case of insecticide resistance, we've got a leaf with some insects on it. The one circled in red is a rare resistant individual. Those resistant individuals, you know, maybe they're occurring at frequencies of, you know, 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 10 million. So they're very rare out there. But we apply an insecticide. We know insects are very numerous. We can kill off the susceptible individuals and leave those resistant individuals who are going to be reproducing better under those conditions. And as we repeat this, going down that sequence of leaves, we see that the ratio of resistant to susceptible individuals is increasing. And what we want to try to avoid is what we see at the bottom when the majority of the population is resistant. So just a little historic snapshot here. If you look at the x-axis on these graphs, we see years going from 1910 to 2010. In the top graph, we've got numbers of arthropod species with resistance, and these are pest species. And in the bottom graph, we've got numbers of records of resistance. So it's not just individual species with some kind of resistance. It's species X with resistance to chemical Y, or species X with resistance to chemical Z. So we see that there's a huge increase in resistance starting, you know, around 1960 and going into the 1990s. And if you're focusing on that top graph, you might start thinking things are looking good, you know, that the problem's not growing anymore, maybe we're doing everything right. But what's playing out there is, you know, most of our pest arthropod species already have resistance. So we're still picking up a few every now and then. But if you look at that bottom graph, what's kind of scary is that those species are acquiring more and more types of resistance. So it's still a growing problem and something that we need to be concerned about. This slide just kind of highlights some of the champions in terms of pesticide-resistant arthropods. We've got the two-spotted spider mite being resistant to over 92 different active ingredients in 367 different cases spread throughout the world. So that's not any one population of that pest that's resistant to all those different chemicals. But if you look at that species throughout the world, it's developed resistance to that many different chemicals. We see things like the diamondback moth, green peach aphid, Colorado potato beetle, which I mentioned earlier, and I'll mention a couple more times because it's a pretty good example of resistance, and the common housefly. So there are some different mechanisms that insects can evolve to deal with these insecticides, and a lot of this is coming from their evolutionary coexistence with the plants that they've been feeding on. These insects, over time, have been having to battle with different defensive chemicals that plants have, like this Colorado potato beetle larva feeding on potato leaves, which are full of nasty toxic chemicals like glycol alkaloids. So over time, they've had to evolve ways to counter those different chemicals. And those chemicals have left these pests forewarned and forearmed, as Wilkinson put it, to deal with insecticides by different biochemical mechanisms, physiological mechanisms, and behavioral mechanisms. And now I'll go through a few slides in which I'll try to explain these different mechanisms. So if you look at this picture here, focus on that circle. And that circle represents what's going on inside of an insect's body. The left half represents the inside of a susceptible insect, and the right half represents the inside of a resistant insect. And I'll use this to kind of show how the different mechanisms play out. So if we look at the biochemical resistance, that's mainly metabolic, so it's tied to enzymes and their ability to break down these different chemicals. So in the middle of that circle, for the susceptible insect, you see those little triangles which represent the insecticide molecules in the insect. If you look at the resistant side, that's depicting that enzymatic activity, breaking down those chemical molecules into non-toxic pieces. We can have things like target site insensitivity. So now we're getting into the physiological mechanisms. And here, if you look at on the susceptible side, you've got the black triangles, which represent those insecticide molecules, connecting into a target site. So that's wherever those insecticide molecules are acting within the insect. It's a nice fit. So those insecticides are going to have their action. However, if you look at the resistant side, you see that the shape of that slot into which that insecticide molecule is fitting, it's changed. It's not as good of a fit. So that insecticide isn't going to work as well. And this is a very simplistic explanation of things. Oops. And then another physiological mechanism is reduced penetration. So we know insects have their skeleton on the outsides of their body, their exoskeleton or cuticle. And insects can develop, certain changes can occur in their exoskeletons, maybe being thicker or less permeable, which will slow down the rates of entry of these insecticide molecules into the insect's body. And not shown here, but also worth mentioning, are changes in rates of sequestration and excretion of the insecticides. And there's also behavioral resistance. So this is kind of simply the ability of an insect to avoid the pesticide. And an example of that is the tobacco budworm, where these caterpillars, when they're in the presence of pyrethroid insecticides, they'll start decreasing the rates at which they're moving around. And by moving around less, they're coming into less contact with the insecticides, and they can survive better than others who are moving around a lot more and picking up more insecticide residues. So a little bit of terminology here, and this is one part that might differ a little bit from some of the other speakers, but I took this from Tabashnik's recent paper where he's defining resistance terms in regards to insecticide resistance, and he kind of has an umbrella term for multiple resistance. So insects or pests that are resistant to multiple insecticides, and the following two terms kind of relate to how that can come about, where you get cross-resistance, which is a case where you have one resistance event conferring resistance to other insecticides. So it's one resistance mechanism allowing that insect to have resistance to multiple insecticides. In contrast to sequential resistance, which is when you get separate events or separate mechanisms occurring over time, allowing that insect to be resistant to different insecticides. Some other terminology that we should go over here before getting into the case study is you know, some terminology tied into how we measure resistance. And if we look at this graph, we've got proportion mortality on the y-axis and increasing insecticide concentration on the x-axis. And the two curves represent kind of the dose response of different insect populations to those insecticides. The blue line represents a susceptible population where it takes less insecticide to kill that insect. And the red line represents the a resistant population where you need more insecticide to kill off that population. That's why that population is shifted over on that x-axis. So a commonly used term is the LC50, or the lethal concentration 50, and that's the concentration of the insecticide that's required to kill off 50% of that population. And then with those LC50s, we can calculate what we call a resistance ratio, and that's how many times more resistant a population is to an insecticide compared to a known susceptible population that has not been exposed to the pesticide. So if there are no questions, based on kind of that general background, I'll dive into the case study here. Just pause a little bit to see if there are any questions. I'm not sure about the remote locations. No? So the soybean aphid, we see a close-up of an individual soybean aphid, and then we see an upper trifoliate of a soybean plant heavily infested with soybean aphids, and then that's a fairly common occurrence still in our fields in Minnesota. Some of the other states, the soybean aphid problem has kind of petered out, but we're still dealing with it. So soybean production and where Minnesota fits in, you know, we're producing over 7 million acres of soybean, getting, you know, over 50 bushels per acre. So Minnesota is a pretty important player in soybean production. Historically, before 2000, farmers could typically grow their soybean and not have to worry about insect or arthropod pests. Less than 2% of acres of soybean were scouted for pests, and less than 1%, 0.1% of acres were treated with insecticides in the north central region prior to the soybean aphid. When insecticides were applied, they were applied mainly for defoliating insects like caterpillars and grasshoppers and occasionally spider mites. However, like I alluded to, in 2000, the soybean aphid was first detected in Wisconsin, and it rapidly spread throughout the north central region. The counties highlighted in red are all the counties in which, or from which, soybean aphid was detected in 2000. And then by 2009, we see with the yellow counties where the soybean aphid was occurring. So now, after the arrival of the soybean aphid and its establishment, we know that this pest can cause up to 40% yield loss. 77% of acres are scouted with now, which is a 40-fold increase. Regionally, there was a 130-fold increase in insecticide application. That's region-wide, but if you look at some states, and I think Minnesota falls into this, you know, 57% of acres sometimes could be treated with insecticides for this pest, and it's resulted in pretty huge increases in production costs. So fortunately, we've had some time to develop a lot of solid replicated research and developed a threshold for managing this pest, scouting recommendations, and we've got those summarized in a North Central soybean field guide for soybean aphid. So we've got a threshold, 250 aphids per plant, applying insecticides based on that. It's mainly the broad-spectrum insecticides, pyrethroids, and organophosphates. Unfortunately, the adoption of other tactics for managing this pest has been relatively low. We know that there are resistant varieties, but again, adoption rates are low. There are some natural enemies that are very effective, but they're not silver bullets. And we're seeing an increase in prophylactic applications, you know, kind of these insurance applications of insecticides, and that can create a ripe recipe for development of resistance in pests. So what do we know about soybean aphid and resistance? If we look in the literature, we see some reports of light resistance, in quotes, to organophosphates in China. And there was some work done in Michigan, published in 2011, where they did some bioassays and found no evidence of resistance to several different insecticide groups for the soybean aphid. However, if we take a step back and look at kind of aphids in general, they've done a pretty good job over time developing resistance to a lot of different insecticides. In this table, we've got the different species listed, and then the insecticides to which they've developed resistance, and those are abbreviations there, but in that little square at the bottom, you see what those insecticides are. It's the benzophenylureas, carbamates, neonicotinoids, organophosphates, organochlorines, and pyrethroids. So you can see that, you know, some of these species, like the green peach aphid, you know, it's developed resistance to, you know, about a half a dozen different types of insecticides. I underlined some of the other aphid species that are in the aphis genus, the same genus, or very closely related to the soybean aphid. So we can see that, you know, if a very close relative or close relatives of the soybean aphid can develop resistance, it's probably pretty likely that, the soybean aphid could also develop resistance. So in my lab, going back to 2013, we've been monitoring populations of soybean aphid from throughout Minnesota, you know, collecting 6 to 8 different populations from around the state, bringing them into the laboratory and subjecting them to these laboratory bioassays in which we're looking at those LC50s, those concentrations required to kill 50% of the population. And in 2013, 2014, and part of 2015, we weren't really finding much for resistance. We were getting some statistically significant differences in susceptibility, but when you look at the magnitude of that difference, the resistance ratios, it was still relatively small. However, in 2015, it seemed like something started changing, where we started getting reports of kind of field-level failures of pyrethroid insecticides. You know, growers, applicators, consultants were really freaking out as they were, you know, applying the insecticides to the soybean aphid, and you know, these guys had years and years of experience managing soybean aphids, and they knew these products should have been knocking down those aphid populations, but they just weren't doing what they should have been doing. So in this map here, I've got two different symbols. I've got red circles and red X's. The red circles indicate counties from 2015 in which we had kind of widespread reports of pyrethroid failures for soybean aphid management. And the X's indicate counties in which we had kind of more scattered reports, maybe just one or two reports of issues. So we see it was mainly focused in southern Minnesota and more heavily in southwestern Minnesota. And that kind of makes sense because that's historically where we've had a lot more problems with soybean aphid. So more and more insecticide application over the years. One example of one of those failures, this is data that was provided to me by a colleague, Bruce Potter, out in southwestern Minnesota, where this is a field where there was a performance issue with the pyrethroids. He went into that field, set up some research plots, and had untreated plots, Tundra at a couple different rates, Hero and Warrior. So those are different pyrethroid insecticides. And what should stand out here is that I guess if you look at the y-axis, it represents the percent population increase, or kind of the population growth rates. And what stands out is that some of those treated plots, the aphid populations were growing as fast as, or faster, than in the untreated plots. So that was a pretty good indication that, something wasn't going right. So we were able to collect some aphids from one of the fields in which we had a performance issue. We brought them into the laboratory and we used what's called a glass vial bioassay, where we treat the inside of glass vials with insecticide, let the insecticide dry so the insides of the vials are coated with insecticide residue. I get undergraduate students to transfer aphids into these vials, and then we come back after time and count how many aphids are surviving. So then looking at those different, with vials set up with different concentrations of insecticides, we can get a feel for that dose response curve, if you remember back to that graph that I showed earlier. In this assay, we did bifenthrin and lambda-cyhalothrin, two very commonly used pyrethroid insecticides, 10 different concentrations, and we assessed mortality at 4 hours and 24 hours, but the data I'm showing you is 4 hours after the aphids were placed into the vials. And what we see here, just notice the title of the slide is not correct. It's not the LC50s. These are the resistance ratios. So remember those resistance ratios. That's the ratio of the LC50s. So for the resistant population and a susceptible population. And in this case, a susceptible population is a laboratory colony that hasn't been exposed to insecticides since soybean aphids have been in North America. And what we see from this one population in Lamberton, these aphids showed 44-fold resistance to bifenthrin. So the field-collected aphids were 44 times more resistant to bifenthrin than a known susceptible laboratory colony. And for lambdacyhalothrin, the other pyrethroid, it was a 10-fold difference. So these are not huge resistance ratios by any means. You know, there are documented literature of, you know, 100-fold resistance and many times more than that for some other insects. But for soybean aphid, this is the first time that we've gotten anywhere near that high of values of resistance. So we had, in 2015, field failures reported in southern Minnesota, and then some laboratory data to back up the idea that there's resistance in at least some of those populations. So then, going into the winter of 2015-2016, with the extension season, talking at different meetings with growers and consultants, you know, we weren't really too sure what to tell folks. You know, we didn't know if that was just kind of a one-off deal, if we'd ever see the resistance problems again. But sure enough, in 2016, this last summer, we started getting reports again of fields being treated with pyrethroids and not getting the expected performance from those products. Again, most of those reports were from southwestern Minnesota. There's one report from up in northwestern Minnesota. And these reports, they weren't as expansive or widespread as in 2015. And we're not exactly sure why that is. One reason could be that 2016 was a much lighter soybean aphid year. There just weren't as many soybean aphids out there. So we probably weren't as likely to encounter performance issues because not as many farmers were treating their fields. So again, we performed glass vial bioassays. This time we were able to get aphids from scattered around the state. And it was very similar to the year before. We used bifenthrin and lambdacyhalothrin again, transferring aphids into those vials and assessing the resistance or the amount of mortality after a certain amount of time. And again, this graph shows the resistance ratios, which are calculated from the LC50s of the different field populations and comparing those to the laboratory populations. So if you look on that graph, you've got the resistance ratios across the x-axis, the different populations of aphids. You see that laboratory population, so that has the resistance ratio of 1, because that's kind of the reference population. And then you see that Rochester was even a little bit more susceptible compared to the laboratory. But as we get up into these two different Lamberton populations, Crookston and Windham, we see statistically significant differences in susceptibility to the insecticides. You know, we're getting up to 3 to 5-fold resistance. Some folks would consider that, you know, light resistance or low-level resistance. And again, that's for bifenthrin. However, when we look at lambdacyhalothrin, we see some higher levels of resistance showing up here. Again, the laboratory population down at the bottom, that has that resistance ratio of 1, and that's because that's the reference. You know, so we're taking that LC50 divided by that same LC50 to get that value of 1. But all the other ones, it's comparing the LC50 of those field populations to that laboratory population. The stars indicate the populations where we had statistically significant differences in susceptibility. And the one that really stood out was Crookston, you know, near 30-fold decrease in susceptibility to lambdacyhalothrin. Windham was over 5-fold. So again, we had a second year where we had field level failures, fairly widespread. You know, it wasn't just a bad batch of product, wasn't one applicator doing something wrong. You know, we kind of ruled that out for both years. And in both years, we have some laboratory data to back up the case that, you know, we've got something going on with these populations where it certainly looks like resistance is developing. So one thing we don't know yet is mechanisms of resistance in the soybean aphid. You know, I talked about the different types of mechanisms kind of in general for insecticide resistance. If we dig into the literature for aphids, we see that, or for insects in general, but focus on pyrethroid resistance, we see some kind of common mechanisms reoccurring, and those include target site sensitivity. So remember, that's when you get changes to the site where the insecticide binds within the insect, so that insecticide molecule just, it doesn't bind, it doesn't work as well as it should. One type of that is called knockdown resistance, KDR or super KDR. I underline that here because that's a fairly common one when you get pyrethroid resistance in aphids. There are metabolic resistance mechanisms, again, where you get different enzymes breaking down the insecticide molecules at faster rates than normal, where you get monoxygenases like the P450s, esterases, and the glutathione S-transferases. And I underline the esterases because, again, those are the more common mechanisms of resistance in aphids. And again, we've got the reduced cuticular penetration. So that relates to how much that insect can pass from the outside of the insect into the insect through the insect's exoskeleton or cuticle. So again, we don't know what mechanism soybean aphid might be employing here, but when we look at aphids, when you have pyrethroid resistance, it's pretty commonly this knockdown resistance or increased esterases. So if we step back and try to think about things, you know, as we're applying insecticides to manage soybean aphid, we're applying insecticides to manage any pest, just because we have a failure of that insecticide, it doesn't mean we have resistance. We got to kind of step back, ask ourselves a few questions, and rule out some other potential causes. One of those could be misapplication of the pesticide. You know, did we use the right rate? Did we have good coverage? The environmental conditions, you know, think about wind, rain, temperature. We know some insecticides perform better under higher temperatures, whereas others perform better under lower temperatures. The timing of the insecticide application, depending on the pest you're dealing with, you could have life stages that are more or less susceptible. Remember from early on in the presentation, I talked about the caterpillars, where a lot of times the small early instars of the caterpillars are more susceptible than the larger later instars. For soybean aphid, that's not much of an issue. You know, I think there's probably some very minor differences in their susceptibility in different life stages, but I don't think it would play out to anything really measurable in the field. And then you also get recolonization by the pest. So if we think about soybean aphid, we know the aphids colonize the fields. They go through many generations on the soybean plants, up to 15 generations in a year. And if those plants get too crowded, the aphids can have babies that'll have wings. And those winged aphids can redistribute themselves to different fields. So if we were to go in, spray a field, we might knock down all the aphids in that particular field. But if we've got one of these recolonization events going on, that field could be very rapidly colonized by new aphids. And they'd be plants that have no predators, because that insecticide application would have likely killed off all the lady beetles and other good insects. So any colonizing aphids can kind of have a free-for-all, and we've seen populations increase very rapidly. So again, I just want to emphasize this, where, you know, if you have resistance, or if you have a failure, you can't assume resistance right away. You have to rule out some other factors. If you can kind of go through this checklist, you know, then, you know, you might be dealing with something that could be resistance, and you know, that's when I definitely want to hear about it. You know, if it's soybean aphids in Minnesota, or, you know, whatever other pest in whatever crop in whatever state, you know, I'm assuming the extension folks in those states would also want to hear about it. So resistance management, what is it? It's a collection of strategies that we want to try to use to prevent or slow down the development of resistance. And why do we want to do it? We want to do it to protect those insecticides as management tools. The process, you know, in talking to folks from the chemical companies, you know, it's a very, very expensive process developing new chemicals, and it's a very timely or time-consuming process. It takes a long time. So we want to try to preserve these insecticide tools because they are important. It's an important thing to have in our IPM toolbox for suppressing outbreaks. So thinking about resistance management tactics, we've got a list here, and I'll kind of go through these one by one. One of the main things we want to do is to alternate the modes of action or the insecticide groups. We can figure out what insecticide groups we're dealing with by looking at the labels. In this example, we see we've got an insecticide from the group 4C. And oftentimes, it's better to alternate individual modes of action for insecticide resistance management. So getting back to the case of the soybean aphid, this table lists a bunch of the different insecticides that are labeled for soybean aphid control. The last two columns in that table list individual products, Some of those have individual active ingredients, some of them have multiple active ingredients. And if you look at that list, you might think, wow, we've got a ton of tools we can use for managing this pest. But if you take a step back and look at that second column, you see that, you know, that whatever it is, 40 or so different insecticides come from only, I think, less than 20 different active ingredients. And if you take a step back from there, you see that those active ingredients are all coming from only three insecticide groups: group 1, group 3, and group 4. And just to give you a little bit of background here, I want to kind of take a bit of a deep dive into what these different insecticide groups are to help you maybe get a feel for how these alternations of modes of action can help for insecticide management. And I think you need to kind of have an idea of how these insecticides actually work on the insects. So if you think about the organophosphates and the carbamates, these are acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. So acetylcholine esterase is a chemical message, or it's an enzyme that breaks down a chemical message going between cells. So in that picture, we've got two long nerve cells in an insect, and it's actually pretty similar to human nerve cells. We've got a very long body of the cell where it's an electrical message being transferred. And then the two cells, they don't actually come into physical contact. There's a little space there called a synapse, and that's where a chemical message is transferred between the cells. And these group 1 insecticides, they act on that, on what's going on in that synapse. And if you kind of zoom in on where the one cell comes close to the other cell, we see these little red balls, which represent acetylcholine, which is that chemical message going from one cell to the next. That acetylcholine binds to receptors on the second cell, and then it starts the electrical message in that second cell. After that chemical message binds to the receptors in that second cell, there's an enzyme that comes around, the acetylcholine esterase, and it cleans out those receptors so that that cell will be ready for the next message. And what these group 1 insecticides do is they inhibit that enzyme so that that second cell, its receptors, are always plugged up with acetylcholine. So it's always activated. It's not able to transmit any messages. If we think about the group 4 insecticides, which are like the neonicotinoids, they also act in that synapse, but in a different way compared to the organophosphates or the group 1 insecticides. What these insecticides do is they mimic that acetylcholine, that chemical message going from one cell to the next. So instead of the acetylcholine binding to the second cell and starting up the message in that second cell, it's this insecticide binding to that receptor, and it stays on that receptor. So the end result is kind of similar to the previous case where that message is getting bound up and it results in death in the insect. The group 3 insecticides, these are the pyrethroids, and they act on a completely different part of the nerve cell. So they're acting on kind of the long body of that nerve cell, and that's where you get that electrical signal being transmitted down the length of a cell. So I kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier on about alternating individual modes of action rather than mixtures of insecticides. And this might differ a little bit from what you'll hear later on. I know in Minnesota, when I'm talking at extension meetings with our weed scientists, either talking before me or after me, we kind of give a little bit different messages here. But the IRAC, the Insecticide Resistance Action Committee, came out with a document in which they state that it's generally less effective to use mixtures. So if you have one product and it has two different active ingredients in it, or, you know, kind of a tank mixture where you're mixing in two different active ingredients, use of those are generally less effective for resistance management than that alternation of individual modes of action. And that's because it's kind of a fine line that you need to walk if you want to try to use these mixtures. They can be effective, but only under certain conditions. You need to take into account the pest susceptibility. You know, do they have resistance to either of those insecticides within that mixture? Are both of the insecticides represented at the registered or labeled rates? What's the duration of residual activity? If one of these products degrades much faster than the other, that could create kind of a ripe recipe for resistance, and again, potential for cross resistance between the two products. So use of mixtures for insecticide resistance management can be done. It can be effective, but it's really kind of, like I said, a fine line that you're walking, because you have to take into consideration all these different factors. The next tactic for insecticide resistance management is using the pesticides properly. So the label's the law. Follow what the label's saying. Use the labeled rates. These use of below labeled rates can actually increase selection pressure for resistance. Make sure you're using proper nozzles, pressures, and volumes. A lot of times, the spray settings for a herbicide application or a fungicide application are not going to be optimal for an insecticide application, and it might not be the right time for an insecticide application for that particular pest. So, you know, those are some things to think about when we're using tank mixes. You know, a lot of folks think, okay, they're going through their field with their last pass of glyphosate, throw in a little insecticide for a kind of an insurance application just in case pests are there. But, you know, it could potentially be making not such a good situation in terms of resistance management. And then the final two elements here, I kind of lump under the umbrella of integrated pest management. Treating that pest population only when it's necessary. And to do that, we need to be scouting the fields and using thresholds. So for soybean aphid, we want to be scouting those fields through R6.5. Regardless of calendar date, the pests don't pay attention to the calendar. So don't use the calendar. You know, be basing your scouting on plant growth stage. And through the R5 growth stage, we want to be using the threshold of 250 aphids per plant, the majority of those plants infested, and those aphid populations increasing. So a lot of people hear about the 250 aphids per plant, but we add on these two additional items, the majority of the plants infested, to make sure we're not treating a field just because there's one hot spot, say, on the edge. We want to make that kind of a field-level decision. And we want those aphid populations increasing because we know there are a lot of natural enemies out there that can help drive down the aphid populations, lady beetles and other predators. And if those populations are already decreasing, there's really no sense in us applying an insecticide. And then the second item under the umbrella of integrated pest management is reducing the likelihood of needing to treat that pest population. So I kind of briefly mentioned before post-plant resistance or the aphid-resistant soybean. We've got several different resistance genes that have been identified in soybean for aphid resistance, and those are called RAG genes, R-A-G, which stands for resistance aphis glycines. In this table, we see the different plant introductions from which those resistance genes have been identified. And in that final column, we see the category, and that's kind of how that resistance plays out. And it can either be antibiosis, which occurs when the plant affects the insect's biology, either its survival or reproductive rates, or it could be anti-zoonosis, and that's when the plant affects kind of the behavior of the insect. It might be that that particular variety or soybean line is less attractive compared to other soybean lines. These data are from a recent North Central regional project. And what we see across the x-axis are different soybean lines. These are near isolines where we've got a susceptible line, a soybean line with a single resistance gene, the RAG1, another soybean line with the RAG2 resistance, and then a fourth soybean line with the RAG1 plus 2 resistance. So that's a pyramided situation where we've got two different resistance genes. And we've got data from multiple states over multiple years. And what's on the y-axis is cumulative aphid days. So that's that measure of aphid pressure over time. So it's kind of like how degree days accumulate over the growing season. And what we see is that all these sites, we have pretty good aphid pressure. The aphid populations were above the economic injury level, which is represented by that red line. And we see when we look at the two soybean lines with the single resistance genes, either RAG1 or RAG2, we see that the aphid pressure was significantly reduced, but it wasn't a silver bullet. You know, sometimes those aphid populations exceeded the economic injury level. However, when we look at that pyramided situation where that soybean line had two different resistance genes, we see that we got very effective suppression of the pest population, and the yield data kind of mirrored this, where we had highest yields from the pyramid and then decreasing as we went to the susceptible line. However, just like with insecticide resistance or any tactic that we're using to manage pests, soybean aphids have developed the ability to overcome these resistant soybean plants, and we call these virulent biotypes. And so far there have been four different biotypes identified. We've got the biotype 1, which has not been able to overcome resistance, so we call that avirulent. And we've got biotype 2, which can overcome rag 1, biotype 3, which can overcome rag 2, and kind of the most scary situation is biotype 4, which is able to overcome the pyramided situation where you have rag 1 and rag 2 in an individual soybean line. So kind of what this means is that we need more and more sources of resistance, and we need our breeders working on pyramiding these resistance genes to get those more effective levels of pest suppression. And in under those pyramided situations, you know, we would hopefully have more resilient type of pest suppression where it'd be more difficult for the pest to overcome that tactic. We also have biological control. So again, this is the use of natural enemies to manage a pest. So we've got things like lady beetles, lace wings, different fungal diseases, and parasitic wasps that act on the aphid populations. We're not encouraging that people go out to their soybean fields and release a bunch of lady beetles, but what we can do is maybe use that threshold at 250 aphids per plant to decide when we're applying the insecticides. And what that'll do is it'll give these natural enemies a chance to act on that pest population before we apply those insecticides. So in conclusion, I just want to emphasize again that insecticides are an important component of the IPM toolbox. We really need these in many situations to suppress pest outbreaks, and that insecticide resistance is a growing concern. So we need to use our insecticides wisely to preserve them for continued use. You know, thinking about integrated pest management, insecticide resistance management. For soybean aphid in particular, we can manage this pest pretty well if we're scouting our fields, using the threshold, applying effective insecticides. However, over the last couple of years, we had those reports of failures from fairly large areas within Minnesota, and followed up on that with laboratory bioassays and documented resistance. So we'll continue to be looking into this situation. And just want to conclude here by, you know, thinking about soybean aphid. Remember, I said there are only basically those three insecticide groups that we're using for soybean aphid management, 1, 3, and 4. So we got the pyrethroids, where I just showed, looks like we have an emerging resistance issue. If we look at the organophosphates, we've got state-level regulatory concerns coming up in Minnesota. There's this particular insecticide, chlorpyrifos, is under review by the federal government. We look at the neonicotinoids. There's a lot of attention there right now. That group of insecticides is under review at the federal level. And at the state level, we recently had an executive order from the governor of the state in which he's put some pressure on the Department of Agriculture to try to take some steps to reduce the use of this insecticide. So we're working with a short list of potential insecticides, and that short list could be getting shorter. So with that, I'll wrap it up here. I want to thank you, and if I have time, I'll try to address any questions. Yes, sir. I think they want you to go to a microphone. They'll bring a microphone to you. Sorry, just so the folks at the remote locations can hear. Stretch those legs.
Couple of questions.
Yes.
One, how common is the emerging resistance in neighboring states? And two, how common is it among growers to use among neighboring?
Okay. So how common is this soybean, the pyrethroid performance issues, you know, for soybean aphid control, how common is that in neighboring states? Just this last year, I've been working with my colleague from Iowa, Erin Hodson, and she had some reports from northern Iowa where, you know, a particular field, I think, was sprayed 2 times, and they weren't able to get control. So we were able to get some aphids from that field. I didn't show the data, but it's looking like, based on some preliminary analyses, that there's some pretty high levels of resistance there. So those are the only reports that I'm aware of outside of Minnesota. But it kind of makes sense that northern Iowa, it's pretty close to where we were seeing issues. And I think your second question was in regards to farmers or applicators' use of below-labeled rates. You know, it is fairly common. I'm not sure, you know, like what percentage of growers are doing it, but I know in some cases, if folks are applying, say, you know, a pyrethroid insecticide for aphid management, they might spike that with a little bit of an organophosphate like chlorpyrifos. So we know the pyrethroids are very effective, but it takes a little while for them to kill off the pest, to kill off the aphids. So if they spike it with that little bit of organophosphate, below labeled rate, usually they'll get that quick kill. And we're also starting to see resistance in two-spotted spider mites to chlorpyrifos in Minnesota. And, you know, it could be from situations like that. You know, when you get into the different tank mixes, you know, with insecticide and herbicide or fungicide, you know, I'm not sure what kinds of rates folks are always using. So, you know, I can't specifically say how much of it is going on, but it is indeed going on. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you, everyone.